Good afternoon. Whoa, that's a little loud. We'll try that again. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I refer to her oftentimes as my half-daughter or my fake daughter, Jocelyn Wallace, is here. It all began on a Friday evening. I had had a very rough week. My chest hurt, and it didn't seem to get any better. So late in the evening, I said to my wife, I think I'm having a heart attack. I'm going to the hospital. So I went to St. Joe's emergency room, and they did the usual poke, prod, stab, EKG, CAT scan, chest x-ray. The emergency room doctor came into my room and he said, well, you're not having a heart attack. We can say that, and I'm not sure exactly what's wrong with you. I can give you some tranquilizers for the weekend, but it's probably just job-related stress. As he got up to leave, he turned and he said, oh, by the way, there's a little spot on your gallbladder, and you might want to have somebody look at that sometime. So I went home, and the pain went away. And that Monday, I went to see my family doctor, Sandy Valley. She looked at the x-rays, and she said, you know, you probably really ought to have somebody look at that. So we went to see a doctor named Kathy Sheridan. She's a surgeon, and she said, well, you got a spot on your gallbladder. Gallbladder's not that big a deal. I think we ought to take it out. Why don't you come into the hospital on Friday at 1 o'clock? It's outpatient surgery. We can take this out. You'll be out of there and home by 5. You get the weekend to recover, and you'll be good to go on Monday. Well, that sounded good to me. So I showed up, and she took out my gallbladder. And I woke up in the recovery room, and there she was, sitting beside my bed, which I thought was somewhat unusual. And the first words out of her mouth was, I'm so sorry. And I said, about what? Well, your gallbladder contained a cancerous malignant tumor. We've never seen this in somebody so young. And I said, well, what does that mean? Well, technically, you're terminally ill, and statistically, you have about 90 days to live. Well, that was not what I wanted to hear. So I said the same thing that all of you would say was, are you sure? Yes, we checked it twice. You got a problem, Mike. I'm so sorry. So I said, what are the options? She said, well, you could go see a doctor at IU Medical Center named Nick Zoronski. He's a surgeon who primarily does liver surgery, and he might be able to help you by doing a liver resection. 2 days later, I had an appointment with him, and surgery was scheduled for about 2 weeks later, as I recall, at IU Medical Center. The surgery is somewhat like a loaf of bread. You take a slice, they send it to the pathology lab, check it for cancer. If it's positive, they take another slice. And they keep slicing away until they can't slice anymore, or until you come clean. Very long operation. I woke up in the recovery room, and who do you suppose was sitting by my bed? Dr. Zoronski. So I said, hey, Nick, Mike, I'm so sorry. And I said, what happened? Well, I'm sorry, but I bailed on your operation. Okay, you must have had a good reason. Yeah, we opened you up, and frankly, there was just so much crap inside that was going to kill you before you ever recovered from the liver resection. So it was a matter of just making the end of your life easier. I bailed. I cleaned up what I could, but I didn't get it all. So, there you are. I said, so in layman's terms, how bad am I? Answer, maybe 60 days, maybe 90. Get your affairs in order. You're done. Are there any options? Well, you might go to see an oncologist, because an oncologist might get you some more time. Well, as soon as I got out of the hospital, I went to see Dr. Annette Moore, Howard Community Hospital. Dr. Annette Moore. Dr. Annette Moore. My shameless plug for a brilliant, very attractive oncologist. At my first meeting with Dr. Moore, she sat at her desk, and I had been usual poke, prodded, and stabbed the whole bit. She sat at her desk, and she was looking at my file, and like so many lawyers that were usually at the table opposite me, I could see her scanning the file, stopping with her eyes from place to place, looking at the information. Then she looked up just a little bit, and I can see that she was putting it all together. And she looked over at me, and I beat her to the punch. I said, how bad is it? Quote, Michael, this disease is going to take your life. I'm so sorry. At that point, I started to cry. Not very manly, I know, but I did. She got up from her chair and she sat down on the examining table with me. She put her arm around my shoulder and she held my hand. You can't buy that, guys. They don't teach that in medical school. And that is when I knew I was in the right place with the right doctor. That was 30 months ago. Wow. Annette Moore. When I rode home in my truck, I will tell you that my life changed. It was like this huge hand came out of the sky and simply swept everything that made up my life onto the ground. I'm told that about two-thirds of the people that receive this information, you know what they do? They go home, they crawl into bed, and they die. I thought about that. But I decided, you know, we'll just see what happens. This will be interesting. I will tell you that at that point, I didn't have any hope, and I didn't have anywhere to turn. And I began to have doubts about my Christian faith. Now, I am one of those people, as they say, who was born in a pew. I am not so sure that that is a good thing. I went to Wheaton College, which is a very good thing. And if you know something about Wheaton College, home of Billy Graham, I think it's fair to say that I was certainly a Christian. And being born in the pew and going to Wheaton, I knew all the answers. So I thought. But I began to have doubts. A little voice in my head would say, you're not really a Christian. I don't like that word, really. I prefer believer. You're not really a believer. This heaven thing and hell. You sure about that? How are you really sure? Who says? I mean, this Jewish carpenter in the Mediterranean? Come on. Be real. I cannot describe it to you other than to say I was tormented. I had trouble sleeping. I said to my wife one evening, I don't think I'm a Christian. She said, of course you are. Don't be silly. I don't know, Lynn. I have real doubts. Real doubts. Bothered me. The only thing I can say to you to describe it is to give you this hypothetical. Let's suppose I walked up to you now and said, are you a believer or a Christian? Virtually everybody in this room would say, well, yes. Wouldn't you? Do you know where you'll spend eternity? And most of you would say, yeah. Good. Because I've just transmitted a virus to you and you've got 72 hours to live. Well, I'll tell you what, gang. There'll be a lot of panicked people in this room. Because there is a big difference between knowing the answers and really knowing them. I went to see Pastor Paul Martin, who is here, and I went to see Morgan Young and Mark Malin, and I told them that I was having doubts. I went to see them because I know all three of them to be good men of God. And they were helpful, but they didn't fix the problem. So I decided that I would study Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I would read C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity. And I would read a textbook that I had at Wheaton called Basic Christianity, written by a guy named John Stott. And I would look at this from the viewpoint that I wasn't going to take anything for granted. I was going to see if there was any basis to this Jesus thing. So I began to study it. The first thing that occurred to me was, have you ever had anybody say to you that Jesus didn't really exist? I've had that. Well, the fact that Jesus really existed, born in Bethlehem, raised in Nazareth, was a carpenter, and was crucified by the Romans, if you want, is a historical fact. You cannot dispute that. Well, you could, but you'd be stupid. You know, like saying the sky is not blue, it's green. It's a fact. Whether you believe it or not makes no difference. It's a fact. So the next question was, as has been asked by many smarter people than I, so who is this man? I came to the conclusion that Jesus was God in human form, sent to this earth to save all of us from our uncountable sins. I came to the conclusion, which frankly astonished me, it's easier to believe that than not. Because if you believe that, everything fits into place. And if you don't believe it, or you refuse, there are simply too many unanswered questions. As C.S. Lewis put it, and as Paul Martin said to me when I was talking to him, it's simple. He's either God in human form on earth, or is the greatest liar ever to exist. It's that simple. I was out on my bicycle on a nickel plate trail, and I was thinking about these things. And it just simply dawned on me that it was true. And you could stake your life on it. So when somebody would say to me, "Are you a Christian?" I can say, "Absolutely." And I know it. "Where will you spend eternity? Heaven?" And I know it. And my doubts went away and have not returned. That is the first thing that I learned through this experience. Maybe it's the most important, but it's what the first thing. The second thing I learned is that there is nothing more important than your family. Now, some of you don't know me. Some of you do. I think by the world's standards, which are pretty low, I would probably be considered to be a pretty good husband and dad. I don't drink much. I think gambling's silly. I've never done any drugs. I haven't chased women. I've been faithful to my wife since the day we were married and before. I'm pretty boring. I don't beat my wife or my children. And so again, by the world standards, I don't know, pretty good husband and dad. But what I did was ignore my children. I allowed my work to take their rightful place. I'm ashamed to admit that. Those of you who know me know that I have a fondness in my heart for Ducati motorcycles, Porsches, fast airplanes. There's nothing wrong with those things. They're a lot of fun. They'll kill you. But I don't have to worry about that anymore. Like my doctor the other day noticed I have a tan, and she says, are you using sunscreen, Mike? And I said, "Why? Well, you might get skin cancer." There's nothing wrong with those things, but they have no lasting value. When you're laying there dying, your last thought is not going to be of your new Harley-Davidson. I can assure you of that. In the course of a lifetime, they have no meaning whatsoever. So what do you do about somebody who devotes a considerable part of their lifetime getting those things? Not very flattering, is it? My wife and I were in bed one night, and she was looking through the family photo album. I looked over at a picture as I was watching television, and I said, "That's a really good picture. Where was that?" And she said, "Well, that's when we went to wherever it was, Texas or someplace." "I don't remember that." "Well, you didn't go." "Oh, let me see that photo album." I started flipping through it, and I'm not in it very much. I said, "I'm not in this, am I?" "No." "You were working. You were working on building your career and providing for us," which is what a good wife would say. How wrong I was. How stupid. The truth is, I worked the hours I worked, which was frequently 6 and sometimes 7 days a week, because I wanted a new Ducati, or another airplane, or car. Had nothing to do with providing for them. That's done. Never had any problem paying the bills. I'm ashamed to tell you that, because I just didn't get it. I never saw my daughter play basketball at the Kokomo High School. I didn't see her play tennis for Kokomo High School. I didn't see my son play basketball for Kokomo. One game, I think. I don't recall ever seeing him pole vault. How stupid was that? Pitiful. Because you can't get it back. It's gone. I had no concept of the importance of being the dad. I just blew it. And I can't fix it. You can try to make up the time, and I have, but it doesn't work. I've been married to the same woman for 38 years. I think that's right, isn't it, Jocelyn? 38 or 9, whatever. A long time. Few of us appreciate our wives, and I'm the leader of the pack. I told my wife in the first 35 years that I loved her about 10 times. That would be generous. Now the day goes by, or never goes by, that I don't tell her that. How simple. It costs you nothing. What do you get out of it? Well, you get laid a lot more. But let me tell you what else you get. I was feeling sorry for myself one evening as my wife and I were there in bed. When your days are numbered, you think about crazy things sometimes. And I don't know how we got on the subject. I think we were talking about hospice care, which I anticipate doing. And my wife reached over and held my hand, and she said, "I want you to know that I will be with you when you die. And I will be holding you, and I'll hold your hand. And the last thing you see on this earth will be my face." What's that worth? You think you can buy that? No. That's worth getting if all it costs you is "I love you" once a day, isn't it? The third thing I learned is about friends. Most people don't have any. They think they do, but they don't. A friend is a person you can share your worst side with, and he'll keep his mouth shut. Tommy DiNardo is one of those people, one of my very best friends. Friends do little things for each other that aren't expected. When I was being operated on, who do you suppose drove to IU Medical Center, hunted up where my wife was, just to sit with her because he knew she would be alone? Tom did that. What's that worth? My neighbor on Winona Lake is a nurse, and she and her husband drive every weekend to the lake. They live in Springfield, Ohio. On Sunday, she drove home with her husband to Springfield, and she got in her car and she drove to IU Medical Center, about a 5-hour drive for her, just so she could be there. What's that worth? Think you can buy it? Nope. I woke up at IU Medical Center one after this operation one afternoon. And there's 8 people from Oak Brook Church. Mark Malin, his wife, Morgan Young and his, and Monty Sanders, and a bunch of people. I thought, good heavens, they must come, it must be the last rites, I'm dying. Carl Stone King and his wife were there. I said, what are you people doing here? And I remember Sherry Stone King saying, where else would you expect us to be? Where are your friends? Says it all, doesn't it? You got any friends who know all the bad stuff about you and still like you? It's a good thing to have. You can't ever have too many. How many of you like to visit people in the hospital? Ooh, grisly, isn't it? People smell, they're in pain. No fun. And you never know what to say, do you? Well, write this down, because I'm going to tell you. You will have no excuse. You walk into the room, you make sure you get the right room. And you simply say to your friend, I'm so sorry you're not feeling well. I'm here because I care about you. Sit down and shut up. How tough is that? That's all you got to do. They won't remember anything about a conversation you may have had, but they'll remember that you were there. The fourth thing that I learned. Gentlemen, Jocelyn, there is a divine plan. Believer or not, you're part of it. We all have a role to play. 2 years ago, I knew that I would be asked to speak to a group of men. A little voice back here told me that. I've been told what to say. This is not really me. I know that right now, this is where I'm supposed to be, what I'm supposed to be doing, and I'm saying what I'm supposed to say. Somebody out there needs to hear this. I know that this stupid disease is going to kill me. I've never thought differently about it. I prayed for healing one time. I figure that God knew I wanted to be healed before I said the prayer. I don't think He has to be reminded, do you? I know about miracles. I've seen some. But I don't think that's going to be part of the plan. I wish it wasn't. But there's nothing I can do about that. Part of His plan, for whatever reason, is that this stupid disease gets to kill me. I'm okay with that. As much as you can be okay with such a thing. So the fourth thing I've learned was, it's part of the plan. Go with it. The fifth and final thing I have to say to you today on a personal, of a more personal note, is I hate this disease. I hate it. I hate it because it takes a little piece of you every day. I used to be able to run up and down this court. I couldn't do it once now. I've logged thousands of miles in the pool downstairs. I can't do that anymore. I can't ride my bicycle on the nickel plate trail anymore. I used to go 15 or 20 miles a day, even up to about 6 months ago. I can't do it. I hurt all the time. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Nothing I can't handle so far, with a little help from morphine. But I don't like that. Could be worse. I have my family. I have lots of friends. Most people don't have those things. I believe that right now I am being held in the hollow of God's hand. And there's not me and Jim Butcher in there, or Alan Brubaker. There's just me. Because I'm that important to him. And he promises that he will provide the strength that I need to get through this. We'll see. I was having lunch the other day with a Jewish friend of mine. I mentioned that he is Jewish only because he's not a believer. He said to me, "So, have you learned anything about being sick?" "A few things." "Really? Like what?" "Well, all sorts of different things, mostly just little things." And jokingly he said, "So have you learned the meaning of life?" And I looked him square in the eye and said, "I have." Well, he was taken aback by that. "You know the meaning of life?" "Absolutely." "What?" "Get yourself right with the Lord. Take care of your family. Take care of your friends. And be a friend. And do your part in the divine plan and do it willingly. And never ever forget 24/7, that's where you are. It's that simple. Nothing more. And that, my friends, is the meaning of life. Thank you.